Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself and reflect on these conversations. In this week's episode, I'm joined by Brittany Valentine. Brittany is a 32-year-old writer, dragon boat paddler, Shiba Inu mum, and mental health advocate. Brittany has had ARFID since birth, but didn't know until a few years ago. They now have an IG account where they are educating others on eating disorders and feeding differences, as well as documenting their own recovery journey. Hello, Brittany. It's so nice to have you on the podcast. Welcome to the Full of Beans podcast.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Yeah, how are you doing today?
I'm pretty good. I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. It's really, really miserable in the UK. It's like we've had 2 days of summer and now it's just gone back to being grey. But it's like, you know, that really sticky weather where like everything feels really close, but it's also really miserable outside.
Yeah, it's just been like massive heat waves over here, and then like thunderstorms, but it's like you never know if this rain is gonna come, so we also have like muggy, just humidity, sticky, gray. It's, you know, it's beautiful.
It's
we love it. Love the weather.
So funny, my partner, his birthday is the 9th of July, and like every year we'll have like a barbecue or a picnic or whatever, and this year he was like, oh, actually I'm gonna like arrange something at a pub, go out for pizza, because who knows what the weather's gonna be like. And we went out for pizza, it was really nice, and then people started like going home and stuff, and we stayed around for a bit, and then we were like, okay, let's go now. Looked out the window, and honestly I described it as American rain, because it was just, you know, that rain where it just comes,
it's explosive.
Down.
Yeah, yeah, and it's out of nowhere. That's my favorite.
Yeah, literally. And then, but in America it stops and then it's nice again, whereas here it did not stop.
Oh wow, that's the best. I always get mad when it's like it's only 30 minutes and I'm like, no, give us the full show. Like I need a day of a thunderstorm. Like,
yes, with the rain pattering against the window. Oh, it's so nice.
Oh, it's so nice. It's the best when it starts like at 10:30 p.m. so you can sleep to it.
Yes.
It's like I can listen to those sounds, like the rain sounds, but it's nothing like the real thing. Like it can never replace like actually
being by the
listening
sea
to the rain.
Yeah, absolutely. So do you want to introduce yourself? Do you want to tell the listeners a bit about who you are and things that you're passionate about?
Yeah, so my name is Brittany. I'm a writer and a journalist, a Shiba Inu mom, and I have ARFID, which is Avoidant Restrictive Food Intake Disorder, and I had no idea what that was until about 2 years ago, and I'm 32. So now I'm on this journey of like trying new foods. And it's not even as simple as that. It's like food exposures, because for a lot of the times, like I'm eating a food that for many people, it's like a regular part of their life. I've never even been near it, or I've never had it before, or like smelled it, touched it, don't know how it's made. Like sometimes I eat something, I'm like, and what kind of meat is this? And like, what animal is it from? And like it's an actual exposure. So that's the journey.
Wow.
Yeah.
Before we go into the ARFID stuff, you just said that you were a mum, and you said something before you said mum. Did you say mum?
No. Oh, Shiba Inu, my dog. Yeah.
I thought that, not human mom. When you said it, I was like, I feel like that's a breed of dog. But I just wanted to clear up what that was. And that now makes a lot of sense. And I love that that was in your description to describe who you are, because I would absolutely have in my description that I am a cat mom. So
for sure. Is it the same as being a mom to a human? Absolutely not. But like, we are mothers nonetheless.
It's better because they don't answer back.
Exactly. Like, it's a lot of work, but it's never going to be as much work as a kid.
No, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly. So, yeah, I mean, it sounds like your journey with ARFID has been a real kind of discovery of things. And I'm really intrigued. So you said that you didn't know about ARFID until 2 years ago, but you're 32, which, so that to me, if I do some quick maths, is 30 years of relationship with food. Did you think that there was something, I guess, different about your relationship with food, or were you just kind of like, surely this is how everyone is?
So I've pretty much known that I was, I guess, quote unquote, different at a very young age, but it was always kind of just dismissed as like the picky eating phase that a lot of children go through. And I had a younger sister that was 4 years younger than me. So she kind of just mimicked what I did. So we both were that way. So it was more like my parents were like, okay, well, they're both just picky kids. So it wasn't really until my sister started getting older and going to friends' house and eating dinner at their house. And she was like, oh, I eat steak now. And I was like, oh, okay, so it's just me. My parents tried to get me to eat things. I would just refuse them. It went as far back as like when I was an infant, I would only eat certain baby foods. So like my mom just kind of knew. And then at 16, I was like, has anyone ever thought that there's something wrong with my taste buds? Because I was like, there's like, it's, I didn't grow out of it. Like, I'm a teenager now and I'm still eating chicken tenders, pizza, pasta. I was eating a lot of fruits and vegetables, which was great, really saved my butt. But I was like, this is weird. So I did get diagnosed with sensory processing disorder, which made a lot of sense why I was having like sensory aversions to food, but I don't feel like it told the whole story. So I had an occupational therapist come to the house and we would actually like do food exposures, but we did a lot of different exercises that like stimulate your vestibular system, like in your inner ear, like nervous system things. I kind of felt very stubborn though at 16, and it was very difficult. And I feel like I didn't fully understand it because we were only working on like the eating part and not like the actual crippling anxiety about food that I had. So I was like, I just don't like, this is hard, but like, I love the foods that I eat. So like, I kind of stopped and I just was like, I guess I'm gonna live like this forever. And that was happening. I was always at a healthy weight. Like, I could be active. I had regular periods. Like, I was fine. I was just very restricted and limited in like where I could go, who I could hang out with, like traveling, and like what kind of restaurants I can go to. And then it wasn't until I started getting more serious with my fiance that I was like, oh, this like really hinders my ability to like function physically, mentally, socially, emotionally, just it's every single aspect of my life. So I was like, there's got to be something. And then I stumbled upon ARFID online, I think mostly through Instagram. And I was like, oh my God, that's what I have. That's what I've had my whole life. But it wasn't added to the DSM until 2013, which is when I was 21. So even that would have been a super late diagnosis. But yeah. So I think it's very, very underdiagnosed for that reason. And a lot of doctors, even therapists, like have no idea what it is. But yeah, so the awareness movement is on the rise.
Well, absolutely. And it's interesting actually, because I've been doing this podcast for 3 years, and I remember when I first did start the podcast, I spoke to somebody about ARFID, and then kind of things have, I think more people have heard about it, but there's still not masses of awareness, and I think there is quite a lot of understanding. And I just wondered if, from your perspective, because eating disorders like anorexia, bulimia, binge eating disorder are so weight focused, people then assume that there's a weight focused element of ARFID, which potentially for some people, I guess there might be, but I think also there can be other things that are involved. And I just wondered, from your perspective, you spoke about that intense anxiety around food, how that came up for you and how that impacted then your relationship with food.
So that is the one major difference, I believe, between ARFID and other eating disorders is that our restriction or aversion is not primarily related to like a fear of weight gain or calories. I think there's something called ARFID plus where that does exist, like it coexists. Like you could have anorexia and ARFID, or you could just have ARFID and body image issues. But like for me, I'm not afraid of food because of what it'll do to me. It's for some people, it's like what it could happen, like the adverse effects of eating, not weight gain though, like throwing up or being constipated or getting sick, or choking. For me, it's just mainly sensory and the anxiety of like the unknown, because I just have no idea about anything of the food, what it smells like, tastes like, what it's going to be like, how I'm going to handle it, etc.
It's interesting because I think a lot of people would be like, oh, well, I maybe haven't tried a food before and I don't get that intense anxiety. So it's almost something I feel people can relate to, but then don't quite understand the intensity and the severity of it.
I think the difference is that like a picky eater might like a person who identifies as a picky eater but that doesn't have ARFID could show up at a party and there's like not everything that they like there. There's something that they haven't had. They might get by. I would starve. Like I would choose to not eat rather than go through that discomfort or even feel like I'm able to push past that anxiety. Now that I know what it is, I've had help from a dietitian and a therapist and like my friends and family. I know that I can do that. But like before, it was like I might as well be allergic because I can't eat it.
Yeah. And what was it like going through the process of food exposure?
So they can be very traumatic, or they can be like really pleasantly surprising and super successful. So I would say from the time I started doing them till now, I've added like 10 to 15 foods to my diet that are now staples. But the most success I've had is like with food chaining. So kind of just going from something I know I like a safe food. And then doing something similar, but just a little bit different, and then going off of that. Because like going from 0 to 100 is like kind of insane. It just will backfire. So like I'll go from chicken tenders to like fried shrimp to like salt and pepper squid, where it's seafood, but it's still breaded and crispy and crunchy. And I'll try like one brand of veggie dumplings, and then I'll try the same brand, but like chicken and veggie. But like this is over months. So I think it's like a matter of preparation for me. And then I tried ramen, and then I went from ramen to like udon, and then udon to like a different brand of udon noodles. So by the time I got to there, I was like, I know what the broth tastes like. I know what the noodles, what the texture is like. But it's a lot of calming myself down to get to that point. And sometimes like my anxiety will be at a 10 before I start eating, and then after like the sixth bite, it'll be at like a 6, and then I'll finish it and I'll be like, okay, it wasn't my favorite, but I'm tolerating it. So I can go from tolerating it maybe the first 10 tries, and then after like 20 times I'm like, oh, this is actually really good. For instance, I would never eat a cooked carrot, could only eat raw carrots, and now I eat fried rice and I'm like, wow, like that was a huge barrier. And then we added soy sauce, and then I added like little scallions, and now I can eat chicken fried rice. But like before, I was like, I don't even want anything on my rice. Like I just want white rice plain, like don't have anything touching it. So, and that's what also helps is the confidence and like remembering that, like, yeah, that was something that I would have been like, I would rather die than try that. And now it's something that I love and I'm getting nutrition from it. So I like keep remembering that each time something feels like a hard no.
I think that's a really important point to make is that, like, the first time you have something or try something, it will probably feel horrific. And I think part of that is because of the anxiety that you have before. And I know, I mean, I very much have not myself had personal experience of ARFID, but my experience when I was starting to introduce foods back into my diet after anorexia was like, I hated it. Like, I'd eat something that everybody else would say was delicious, but I would hate it because of the anxiety, because of the thoughts
That's
in my
so
mind. It wasn't
interesting.
that, yeah, it wasn't that it necessarily tasted bad. It was just how it was the anxiety associated with it. And I used to say to my therapist, I just want to have a bowl of lettuce. Like, it's so much more delicious. And she would be like, no, the bowl of lettuce is something that you're comfortable and safe with. But then now, the more that I have tried different foods and introduced more foods into my diet, now going and having, a meal out, I'm going for a meal out actually after this call together, and I've not really even thought about it. Whereas a few months ago it would have been like, well, I've got to restrict for the whole day.
You would
But
have
the
had so
more and
much
more
more
you do
food
stuff,
noise.
yeah, exactly. Which, yeah, it's difficult when you're in the moment to tell yourself that, but then once you start doing it more and more, It gets a lot easier.
It really is very mental, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to know what food shocked you the most in terms of like the one that you were like, I have the most anxiety, and then actually, you really enjoyed and thought, oh, this is actually quite nice.
Actually, I think it would be ramen and udon noodles because soup used to be like the biggest fear food for me because I just thought it was so gross. Like, I just couldn't get past like the wetness and the texture and like all the different ingredients like touching each other and like swimming around in the broth. And I think what pushed me through that was like the culture of ramen and noodle soup. My fiance is Chinese, so like I'm surrounded by a lot of like Asian food all the time. So I'm like, it's a practical choice for me to engage in it. And a lot of my friends love noodle soup. And I'm like, I know everyone loves ramen, not everyone, but I'm like, I want it. But also the fact that I did it was a huge shock factor. And I think after I got through that barrier, I was like, okay, I can keep going and I can keep trying because like we got through that one.
Yeah, I think that's the thing though, isn't it? It's like once you show yourself you can, if you've got a really big fear against something and you show yourself you can do it, it's like, oh, well, if I managed to do that one and there was an element of enjoyment there, then what else am I going to be able to do? Those foods that maybe feel a little easier definitely helps to navigate that.
Because then like you like took something, a situation where your body usually feels very unsafe, and then showed your body that actually it is safe and like it could be a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for sharing your personal experience. I think it's really good to hear it from the perspective of somebody that's been through it, not only for people that are going through it themselves, but also for people that haven't been through it but want to have a bit more of an understanding. And another thing that I know we were going to chat about today, which I think is the first reason we started chatting, was the use of cannabis in ARFID recovery. Which I think could be seen, there'll be some potential controversies, but also I think it's a really interesting topic. So, just to start with, I know what you wrote a blog about it. Do you want to kind of explain the endocannabinoid system and then how that links to eating disorders?
So I am not a doctor. But very quickly, the endocannabinoid system, it's kind of like an extra nervous system we have in the body. It regulates and balances appetite, digestion, mood, metabolism. But it's also directly related to food intake and eating behaviors. And there's two receptors. The system has two receptors. And in both animal and human studies, it shows that like the CB1 receptor increases appetite and the perceived reward value of eating. So the munchies, if you will. And so for me, when I use cannabis, like I think it's mostly the CBD that's calming me down, like body and mind, to either just eat, to be in the mood to eat more regularly, or to like do an exposure. When my anxiety is at a 10, like I can get it to maybe a 7 before starting, which makes it a lot easier. I know some people are using it for like nausea and digestive system symptoms, or to more easily like go out and eat with others, things like that. But mostly, I think it's increased appetite.
So from my understanding with cannabis, there's like two parts to it. One is the CBD part and then one
Yeah,
is the
the THC.
THC.
The THC is actually what gets you high, and then the CBD is like the calming aspect.
So could you might not know this, but would it have the same impact if you just had, let's say, like a CBD oil that's not the bit that gets you high, or do you need the THC bit as well?
I think you need the THC because the THC is what's giving you the increased appetite part.
Because it's really interesting, because when I saw that you spoke about it, I was thinking about my own journey, and obviously at university, it's drugs and all sorts. And I I found it quite challenging because on the one hand, it was like, well, if I smoke cannabis, then as you've said, like it reduces my anxiety. I got the munchies, so I was more inclined to eat. However, I got to a point where it was like, I can only have these foods when I'm high, because it would almost be like, because I'm high and I'm with friends and I've got the munchies, that's almost like a physiological reason of why I'm hungry.
Yeah.
And I would let myself eat more. But then when I wasn't high, I'd be like, no, you can't have that. So like I'd let myself have a jam bagel when I was high, but there was no way that I would let myself do that when I wasn't. So have you experienced anything like that where it's maybe had the adverse effect in the long run?
I think, yeah. So when I told my dietitian that I do that sometimes, she was like, that's great that it helps, but you want to make sure that you can do exposures with nothing. Mm. And that you don't always need to smoke in order to, or consume any kind of cannabis in order to do them. And I was like, no, that's not going to affect me. It does. So I kind of have to go through periods where I don't at all and just see that I can actually keep doing exposures. Mm. I think it's best to do it in periods so you don't get like a physical dependence or a tolerance where you're actually needing more to get that effect, which, you know, it becomes expensive after a while and it becomes just like all consuming and you don't want that. But it's good to go through like periods. I think it's really good for people that aren't eating regularly because it helps like balance out your hunger cues. Like that's what helped with me and also with weight restoration. And I think the more I was able to do food exposures that way, the more I was getting that confidence. So then without it, I was like, okay, well, I can do it again. And I just know I need to get calm. But yeah, so I wouldn't necessarily recommend it for every single person with ARFID or every single person with an eating disorder. But I think it can be helpful to do it like intentionally before, during, or after like eating situations.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point there of the whole, like, you know, not doing it all the time so that you get a dependence on it. Because I think, you know, especially eating disorders, there can be quite addictive personalities.
Right. So then you might just be replacing one addiction with another.
Yeah. And I think that was when I first saw your post about it, I think that was my biggest worry of like, well, one, what if it took somebody from, you know, an eating disorder to then a drug dependence?
Yeah.
But then also, you know, weed is often called a gateway drug. In terms of, like you just said there, like people having to have more and more of it.
And then they're like, oh, what if I tried something else? And then it's a slippery slope, has the potential. Yeah.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I think in your post, you did, there was a bit of research in there. Has there been any research looking at like how to manage it in terms of that?
Unfortunately, not that much. The only study that I know of was one done by a dietitian, Lauren Sharifi, and an ARFID advocate, Kevin Jarvis, where they actually just surveyed people that use it either medically or recreationally to benefit them, to improve ARFID symptoms. And there was one place I found, I think it was Integro Wellness. I think they're actually in the UK. I don't think they're US-based. That like started to talk about specifically ARFID and cannabis, but I'm not seeing a lot of it lately. And I think it's because it's like not very legal worldwide. It's still a little bit taboo, even medically. But I think if you are in a part of the world where it's legal medically, like I would look into getting a card because you actually have to have an appointment with a doctor and like you can discuss all your symptoms and like,
right,
get all those questions out at the get-go. And then there's also like really cool advisors when you go to the dispensaries that can help you find like the right strain for like your specific things. And maybe people could just like use topicals, you know, if it's like for nausea or things like that, and like how much to use and when and stuff like that. But yeah, I wish there was more. I wish we knew more about it.
You mentioned that there was research done on like personal experiences. And I just wondered, I know you mentioned a little bit at the start about what symptoms, but what was the sort of general or what were people's experiences of having cannabis and them it supporting ARFID?
Yeah. So based off that study, some of the benefits were people being able to find new safe foods and expand their diet, having more enjoyment from eating, food tasting better, reduced sensory distress and overwhelm, increased intake, improved hunger cues, being able to eat out with others more, and reduced negative emotions around eating behaviors. One thing that I found interesting about that, I think it was they there was also a benefit that said like being able to like challenge irrational fears about eating. And I've noticed that like sometimes it'll just be two hits and I'll just sit down and be like, what am I actually afraid of? Why am I afraid of food? And I'll be like, so I'll get really deep into some of these like root causes and like the emotional baggage, and I'll be like dissecting it. And then I'm like, you know what? Like, it doesn't matter how long it takes. Like, I can just keep trying foods. And I get like these epiphanies or like mental breakthroughs sometimes that have nothing to do with actually eating, but I think it's clearing some of that like mental and emotional space to do exposures. Because I think a lot of people that have ARFID that have had it since birth have a lot of food trauma. With people forcing them to eat when they didn't want to, which when you find out in adulthood that like recovery means like it could mean trying new foods, it's like I don't even want to get past that. So I think that's an aspect that should be explored more. Because I do a lot of journaling, I do a lot of poetry writing when I'm high. That's like getting deep into the stuff that I'm doing in therapy, but also without that's like kind of reducing that internalized shame and ableism and like getting to the roots of like your fears and anxieties. So, and that's huge. So some shadow work, if you will.
It's really interesting, and it reminds me of I did an episode with a lady called Jennifer, and oh my God, I think, oh, what's it called? The like hallucinogenic part of mushrooms.
Psilocybin?
Yes. And
Yes,
it
I love
sounds,
saying that.
well, I did not in the podcast because I was like, I literally can't speak. It sounds very similar to that. I mean, the psilocybin trials are, you are supported by a therapist with that because it allows you to sort of navigate. And but I think because, well, this was for anorexia, but because there can be so many suppressed emotions, often you can't get to the core or the crux of what's causing eating disorder because there's just so many barriers. And the psilocybin, it was like psilocybin assisted therapy. And so it would allow you to untap that, and you would be guided through the therapist, and that would allow you to get to much deeper than you maybe would do if you hadn't had the psilocybin. But obviously the big thing there was making sure that you had the support of a therapist. But it sounds very similar with what you're talking about in the way that the cannabis impacts you, and that you're able to journal and, you know, maybe get to the core of what's going on. And I just love that you're like, what am I even afraid of? Like, that's such a high thought.
It really is.
I was
'Cause when I'm
like,
sober, I'm like, I know exactly what it is. But I'm high, I'm like, you know what? It's just food, girl. Like, just eat
yeah, but
it.
that's the thing, isn't it?
But
Like, maybe
it's not like that.
when you're high, you do see the bigger picture of it, and it is like, yeah, but what are you actually afraid of? Like, what evidence do you have for that? Whereas when you're sober, it's like, you know,
There's
it's
no challenging those thoughts. Because it's just fact. But when I'm high, I'm like, wait a minute, is this a fact or a feeling? And like, where does that come from? And like, maybe we can get past that. Like, it just feels more like I'm more free to do that, more safe to do that somehow. It's interesting that you bring up psilocybin because I've been thinking about that a lot. There is a woman on TikTok that I found. I believe her name is Diane. And she's supposedly does not have ARFID anymore, which is not a sentence I thought was like possible. And she did psilocybin assisted therapy. And she was like, for 27 years, all I could eat was like bread and cheese. And now she's eating like all these things. And I'm watching her videos and I'm like, oh my God, my brain would just never. And there's, I'm gonna have, I'll have to send you an article so you can put it like in the show notes. But she has like all these videos being like, I had ARFID for 27 years. Can I eat a pickle? Can I eat sushi? And she's eating it and like liking it and exploring it. And she said that she kind of externalized ARFID as like a monster or something, like outside of her. And she like had a conversation with it. And I was like, what is going on?
In
So
within within the psilocybin assisted
within this
therapy.
one session, yeah, I was like,
One session.
Yeah. So it's almost like it
Whoa.
sounds so too good to be true. And I don't know, like, I have to read the article again. I don't know if this was like with a doctor or she did this like on her own. But I wonder if the same would be true with like microdosing, you know, if people don't actually want to have a trip, but they still want to experience maybe some of those benefits.
Yeah.
There's
I mean,
so much
I
to
think
learn.
from my perspective, I would always recommend that with that sort of thing, particularly with psilocybin, that people do it with support.
For sure.
Because I think
Yeah.
that a lot of
And
these
everyone's
things as
brain is
well.
so different, and I feel like there's a lot of risk factors. Because I have bipolar disorder, and I'm like, I don't
Oh,
even know if I
wow.
should do anything psychedelic at all. So I'd
Yeah.
have to figure that one out.
Yeah.
But it does open up a lot of possibilities, at least for adults with ARFID.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, but I think my recommendation would be always to get like medical support with that just because it
Yeah.
can go so wrong. And I think
Like,
especially
real
with,
quickly.
yeah, especially with things like mushrooms, you know, if you're not in a very comfortable environment with people that you trust and
Yeah.
things like that, you know, I've heard quite bad
Horror
horror stories of
stories.
people. And
Yeah.
especially if you're in a vulnerable position where there's an eating disorder involved, I can imagine that that could be quite difficult. And I was just wondering as well with that, if you've had any difficult times of being high.
I've just experienced like a lot of increased anxiety, so like the opposite effect, and sometimes paranoia. But that's like only when I was smoking cannabis that wasn't medical grade, and like I didn't know
Okay.
really where it came from, and I was just getting it from friends when I was younger. But like since I've switched over, haven't had that many bad effects, other than just being very sleepy.
So when you do it, you get it medically, like it's given to you from the doctor, basically.
Not the doctor, but like the dispensary people.
Yeah,
Yeah.
so it's
So
from
you
like
have to.
a specific kind of approved place.
Yeah. So like I'm the only one that can get in. If you don't have a card, you can't even get in the building. Like it's very
Right.
official. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I think that's a really interesting point to make because obviously in the UK, cannabis is not legal.
Yeah.
So I guess
It's,
for
yeah.
people listening in the UK, you know, it's going to be more of a difficult challenge. But in the US, obviously, some states it is legal. But you know,
Yeah.
I think that there's definitely a lot more medical research coming out about the impact that medical cannabis can have and the benefits that it can provide. But I think that, I don't know, it's really, I genuinely don't know where I sit with it because I think
Yeah.
that it's
I don't think it's for everyone, but I think it has like
no.
potential.
Definitely. And I think that the whole argument of like alcohol's worse for you and you know we are I mean particularly in the UK I don't know what it's like in Philadelphia but we are a society that heavy drinking is
Oh,
completely
yeah.
normalized and there's
Really
no
big over here,
benefits
too.
from that.
There's really only cons. Like, it's pretty bad.
Yeah, absolutely. Is there like a minimum age in
Yeah, 21.
Right, okay.
Which,
Yeah.
does anyone follow that? No. But,
Oh dear.
I did because I just don't like drinking. That's another thing is like I don't even like the taste. Like that's a very big thing
Right.
with ARFID. Some people don't even like anything besides water. I do,
Wow.
but alcohol is just never, if it's not super fruity, I'm like, that's disgusting. Like I can't.
And is that something that, because I've never actually spoken to anyone with ARFID about drinks, actually. It's only ever been about food. Do you find and have you found talking to other people with ARFID that drinks also can be a challenge?
Yeah, I do have a friend Cassidy, and she will only drink water, like not coffee, smoothies, milkshakes, milk, orange juice. But I am good. I like water and soda. I like juices. Not a big coffee person, but like I'll drink coffee drinks. But yeah. But alcohol, not a fan.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like you
Which
said,
I don't
it's
feel like I'm missing out,
no,
honestly.
exactly. I don't really think there's any
No.
positives. And you said when you were talking about Diane, the lady that said, you know, I used to have ARFID and you said I didn't
Yeah.
think that would be
I was like,
possible.
what?
Do you think that recovery is possible from ARFID, or do you think it's something you'll always kind of have to navigate? It's just that the foods that you eat will expand.
Yeah, that's a little bit of a fuzzy concept for me because I think it's it's classified as an eating disorder, but I think for some people it's like directly related to neurodivergence. So like I'm always going to have sensory processing disorder. Like I'm not like restricting, in unhealthy ways anymore, but like I can still try something new and like emetophobia warning, like throw it up. And I'm just like, like that's something that I still might be navigating forever. Like I can't sometimes kiss my partner before he's about to eat something that is already, the smell is like making me gag. So I'm like, I don't know if that's something that I like mentally recover from, because it's very like psychosomatic, it's very physical. But I think recovery looks different for everyone with ARFID. For me, like I am having a lot of success with exposures, but I don't think it's like the end all be all for everybody. So yeah, I think my diet will look different, but I might always like eat like somebody with ARFID. Or I might just, I think it's more about healing my relationship with food so that like I'm just less afraid. Like I might always be having sensory distress, but I guess like full recovery would be like the willingness and enthusiasm and like ability to try new foods in nearly every situation. Yeah. Or just like less anxiety and like less food noise.
Yeah,
Yeah.
definitely. I mean, you were mentioning earlier how, your partner is Asian, and then also, like, it limits your ability to travel and, try new things. And I think that that for me would definitely be the biggest part. And that was one of the biggest parts about my recovery, was like, I don't want to have these limitations on where I
Yeah,
can go or who I
that's
can
what
go
it
out
is.
with or what I can eat. And I have always said, and I think everyone's recovery and the way, the how far they go with it will look very different. But I've always seen it that I'll probably have, some behaviors and some, because at some point they do, whether this is the right way to put it or not, they do help me. When I feel like the world is completely going against me and I just need something to ground me, sometimes that helps. But I think the difference is how much you engage in it and how far you take it. And if I reach a point where I can comfortably go out for dinner and not look at the menu beforehand and just be happy and engaged, that for me is, I think
Yeah.
that's a pretty good point to reach.
Right. Like for me, I think I used to think about recovery as eating like everybody else around me, which is just very unrealistic. But for me, I think recovery is now like being able to travel to a country I want to travel to and just get something off the menu, even if there's only one thing I like off the menu. Or going to a restaurant where everyone else is eating something different and I'm eating maybe three different appetizers, but like no one really is batting an eyelash because I'm eating. Like even if I go to a Mexican restaurant and I'm eating chips and guac or like a veggie taco, that would be huge, because before it'd be like I'm just sitting there. I'm like, it's more about I want to participate more in life. Like that's what recovery looks like.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and I completely agree. And it's interesting that our sort of like motivations for recovery are so different when, we've struggled with different things. But for me, it is literally like before I wouldn't have gone, because the anxiety of going and
Yeah.
people seeing me eat and things
Right.
like that would have been way too much. Whereas now I'm going. So
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
amazing
Yeah.
to be able to participate and not feel like you're missing out.
Yeah, no more FOMO.
No more FOMO. Yeah, exactly. No, that's definitely, I'm like, it's so funny because I've gone from like with weight restoration, I'm now like gagging for social events. And people are like,
Right.
Hannah, like, I don't want to do something tonight. I don't want to do something again. I'm like, but guys, it's been so long. Like, I've had so much
Gotta
like
go out.
restraint.
Yeah.
We've got to do it all the time. But yeah, well, thank you so much, Brittany. It's been really interesting to chat to you, and I think that it's definitely food for thought, pardon the pun,
Oh,
in
no, I love good
terms
pun.
in terms of kind of things going forward. So, is there anywhere people can reach out if they have any questions for you or want to find out more about your journey?
Yes, they can follow me on Instagram at My Plate, My Business.
Nice.
Because it's
Very
our
much
plate,
like
our
that
business.
name.
It's very, it
Exactly.
is always on brand. It's literally my brand.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much.
Thank
And
you.
yeah, it's been lovely to have you on.
Bye.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode, so be sure to subscribe.
Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.